Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In his new book, The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens, today's guest, Daniel Hatcher, details how states, in partnership with private contractors, have turned the poor and the needy into lucrative sources of revenue. He writes, quote, states and their human service agencies are partnering with private companies to form a vast poverty industry, turning America's most vulnerable populations into a source of revenue. The resulting industry is strip mining billions in federal aid and other funds from impoverished families, abused and neglected children, the disabled, and the elderly poor. End quote. He writes about what's happening in Maryland, for example. The state foster care agency has hired a company called Maximus to find children whose parents are deceased and to increase the number of children who are determined to be disabled. This is not to provide these children with help, but to enable the state to take their disability and survivor benefits. Here in California, Maximus is partnering with California for the CHIP program, which serves over 885,000 children. That's Children's Health Insurance Program. So how does this industry work? How does it manage to siphon billions of dollars of federal funding earmarked for the poor and the vulnerable? Why doesn't this get more attention, and what can be done about it? Daniel Hatcher is professor of law at the University of Baltimore, where he teaches the Civil Advocacy Clinic. He previously worked for the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau and the Children's Defense Fund, and his new book is called The Poverty Industry, and he joins us from Baltimore. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, it's great to have you. I have to say, when we read this book, we just kept shaking our heads and wondering, why doesn't this get more attention? Why haven't we heard more about this? And you write that this has really been little understood because these practices are mostly hidden from public view. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure, and you know, through the process of my advocacy and research over the years, I've often had the same feeling of shaking my head and anger, to be candid, and that's what's driven a lot of my research into these issues. I think, unfortunately, much has been occurring because most of us are unaware, and my hope through the process of writing this book is if I can help increase awareness, that awareness might help spur need to change. But you mentioned the example out of Maryland, which is also happening in California and unfortunately across the country, where state foster care agencies are taking resources from children in their care, taking survivor and disability benefits, sometimes more, and I can talk about that more. But that's usually done without providing any notice to the children or the children's advocates in the process of applying for their survivor benefits or disability benefits, or when the state takes over control of the money as representative payee. So those children who are supposed to benefit from these funds that belong to them aren't even told of the process. So they have no awareness that this has been happening across the country.
We'll talk about that in more detail in a couple minutes, but I also have to say that I wondered what your intentions were when you wrote this book, because as you know, so many people, a lot of conservatives, oppose social programs and are working and have really successfully gutted a lot of these programs. And you write many times in your book that you're not writing this to support arguments to cut government aid programs. You are exposing this to stop the what you call the poverty industry from misusing the funds, and you argue that those funds should be used as intended. So can you also talk about that?
Sure, and that's absolutely correct. So I don't think any of the research or the practices that I've exposed in the book support arguments to cut the aid funds or the aid programs. You know, there's a huge need in our country. The vulnerable populations are in need of more assistance, and the agencies are underfunded. So if you have situations where you have a governor in a particular state that's working with a contractor and is mismaximizing and then misusing aid funds, the answer isn't to cut that aid from those individuals who truly need the help. The answer is to stop the misuse.
Now, you have so many examples in your book. You personally have worked with foster care children, so you know of what's going on there on a personal level. You've also written about how older people in nursing homes are exploited, how people with disabilities are exploited. How did you find all of this information?
Well, it's sort of connected over time. So as you mentioned, my first experience as a legal aid lawyer almost 20 years ago now is representing foster children in the Baltimore foster care system. And I was overwhelmed both by my caseload and by the circumstances that I encountered that the children were going through, both that brought them into care while they were in the largely broken foster care system, and then as they struggled out of care. And then I also represented individuals at legal aid in broad areas of poverty law, representing impoverished adults. So through that, I started encountering examples of not just the difficult circumstances the individuals were facing, but situations where the systems that were intended to help them were actually sometimes not. And sometimes the agencies that exist to serve, right, those agencies also seek to exist, and they were putting their own fiscal self-interests over those that they are supposed to be helping. And the most stark example is, as we mentioned, regarding foster children. So that was the first example that I encountered, and I started to dig, and I encountered more and more regarding the Medicaid program, what's happening in nursing homes, disproportionate share hospitals, those hospitals that serve a disproportionate share of the poor, and the child support program, and it just keeps connecting and connecting, unfortunately, in terms of how often this is occurring.
And the other thing I struggle to understand is once this money is siphoned from the people who are supposed to get it, where does it go? How does that process work?
Right, and that's a great question, and that's a maze to follow sometimes. You know, state by state, the budget process can vary, and the transparency can vary, and sometimes this is happening more at the county level or even more local level than that. So it can be difficult to follow the money. And if you just take the issue of states taking foster children's benefits, one of the arguments from the state foster care agencies is that the foster care agencies are underfunded, so they need more money, so they should be able to take the children's benefits to pay themselves back for the foster care, cost of care, and then they have more money, right? But what's happening with that is across the country, usually the states are reducing the budget outlay to the human service agencies, in this case the foster care agencies, based upon how much money the foster care agencies are taking from the children. So it's usually resulting strictly state savings. And I think the reason this is largely happening is because states are cash strapped. Both red states and blue states alike are unwilling to raise sufficient revenue through general taxation, so they've been looking for money elsewhere, you know, even these behind-the-scenes mechanisms. You know, we've reached a point where foster care agencies that exist to serve abused and neglected children are actually taking money from those very children.
So tell us more about how this works, because you represented a former foster child in Maryland. This is Alex. He's in the introduction. He was taken into foster care at age 12 after his mom passed away. And over a six-year period, he was moved at least 20 times between temporary placements and group homes. And then soon after losing his mom, he learned that his older brother might be able to care for him, but then his brother died. There were hopes that he could go live with his father, but then his father died. I mean, what this boy has gone through. Now, he didn't know this. Of course, how would a 12-year-old? But he was eligible to receive Social Security survivor benefits after his father died. And without telling him, the Maryland Foster Care Agency applied for those benefits on his behalf, and they also applied to become his representative payee. How is this allowed to happen?
That's a wonderful question, and I think there are legal challenges that can be brought across the country to this practice. So as you mentioned, Alex, you know, and it's not just that he could have benefited from the survivor benefits, which belong to him. You know, like his father earned these benefits for him, and they were owned by Alex. So survivor benefits you can be eligible for when you work and pay into the systems, much like life insurance, and that money could have provided not just an invaluable cash benefit to Alex when he was struggling to leave care, but that emotional connection, right? You know, he could have known that he had this money that was available for him to use to benefit himself that was left to him by his deceased father, for a child who had largely felt abandoned and lost, you know, in this system. I think it could have provided an invaluable benefit. But so you have agencies that the way they're getting control of the children's money is to take on a fiduciary relationship, right, to become a representative payee over the children's funds. That means they're only supposed to manage and use the children's money to best serve the children. But instead, they're literally taking the children's money to pay a cost that the children have no legal obligation to pay for. So I don't see how that's not a breach of fiduciary obligation, and I hope advocates in more states bring those claims.
You also write that after taking Alex's funds, the agency hired a private revenue contractor to learn how to obtain more resources from foster children. How pervasive is this across the country?
It's pervasive and increasing. All states, unfortunately, have been in the process of one level or another of taking resources from children, foster children, and many states are now starting to reach out to private contractors, or the private contractors are reaching out to them. So in Maryland, I obtained contract documents, both an initial contract where Maximus was hired to help do an assessment report to look at how the state might be able to obtain more resources. And then the state rolled out that contract statewide, hired Maximus to help obtain more disability and survivor benefits from foster children. One of the documents actually indicated where Maximus described foster children as a revenue-generating mechanism, right? You know, so it's all about the money. But I do have to say with that, you know, like I've got big concerns, you know, with this effort by states working with revenue contractors in that way, and some of the language that I've seen in state contract documents from these revenue contractors. You know, children are treated as if they're resources on a revenue maximization conveyor belt, you know, triaged and scored and ranked for terms of which kids can bring in the most money. But at the end of the day, you know, the companies are helping the states, the foster care agencies in the states, to obtain these resources from children, but it's the state leaders who are then deciding to take that money from the children. You know, it's the governor of Maryland right now who's taking money from abused and neglected children in their care, and the same thing is happening in California and San Francisco. San Francisco has contracts with revenue contractors at the county city level, much like Maryland has done.
Can you elaborate on that? What else do you know about what's happening here in San Francisco? And then we'll talk more about Maximus, because I'm guessing most people have never heard of this corporation.
Sure. So California-wide and also in San Francisco, there's been a similar effort to obtain foster children's benefits and then using those funds as a state revenue source rather than using the money to help children. And there have been contracts, I believe, by both contractors in California, both by a contract by the name of the Public Consulting Group and also by Maximus to help with this process. If I'm not mistaken, I believe both companies have been involved in contracts with San Francisco. I should mention, I worked on federal legislation several years ago with former Congressman Pete Stark out of California, where he was introducing legislation to try to put a stop to this practice where the children's own funds would then be conserved in plans that would help those children as they aged out of foster care. And unfortunately, the federal bill did not make progress. But it's been a very similar version of that has been reintroduced by a congressman just recently, within the last couple of weeks, by a congressman out of Illinois by the name of Congressman Danny Davis. So I'm hopeful that, you know, through increased awareness, that there might be movement for needed change to stop this practice.
And when you look at, let's take San Francisco as an example, can you explain how these decisions are made? Who ultimately decides that they're going to bring in a private contractor like Maximus, for example, to take the funds that are supposed to go to foster children?
Right. I think that's a great question. And I should clarify initially, you know, like at the caseworker level, you know, the frontline caseworkers, I think most frontline caseworkers are trying hard and want to provide excellent service for their clients. Mm-hmm. And that's not at the level in which this is occurring. You know, this is happening much higher up at the secretaries of the state human service agencies, or at the county human service agencies, and at the governor's office. So what I've seen with contract documents, I think the way it's happening is it's really just a search for money, right? So you have these human service agencies are underfunded. They need more money to provide the services that are necessary for vulnerable populations, right? But it's just nonsensical to have a foster care agency to say, we're going to fund ourselves, we're going to try to get more money by taking resources from the very abused and neglected children that we exist to protect. That's nonsensical at best. And even then, even if you could rationalize that, which I can't, even if you could rationalize that, the agency isn't getting more fiscal capacity through this process, right? It results in state savings, not more revenue for the agency. So it's happening at the highest level of these agencies, and it's in the search for the funds. And I think the agency leaders in this case have lost their way. It's happened because there's been this subversion of mission. I think mission matters, right? You know, these agencies exist to serve and protect the best interests of their beneficiaries, to protect the public welfare. If that mission shifts to maximizing revenue over maximizing the public good, harm results.
Today we're speaking with Daniel Hatcher about his new book, The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. He exposes how states, in partnership with private contractors, have turned the poor and the needy into lucrative sources of revenue. And he has personal experience with this. He has worked for the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau and the Children's Defense Fund. He has worked with foster children. He is now professor of law at the University of Baltimore, teaching the Civil Advocacy Clinic. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for Daniel about what he has found, if you have personal experience with this, if you work for city government and you're aware of how this process works, we'd love to hear from you. If you work for a social service agency and you'd like to weigh in, you can also be anonymous. You can call us at 866-798-8255. If you have confronted agencies with these unethical practices, we'd love to hear from you. Daniel has solutions. He says one of them is that people need to get outraged in order for this to change. So what are your thoughts? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to ask Mr. Hatcher if he had uncovered any of this with specifically people with disabilities or disability insurance payments from Social Security, and if that has any nexus with nursing homes, and if anybody has ever come into a nursing home and tried to take control over a patient's disability benefits they get through Social Security, or how that works.
Thank you for the question. So with most of the research I've done regarding the Social Security disability payments, it's been regarding youth and foster children, and that's where they have to have a representative payee because they're minors, although that can happen as well with someone who's not a minor if they need somebody to manage their funds to help make them make decisions about how to best use the money. I honestly have not researched the question of whether or not the Social Security benefits are being diverted for nursing home residents, but what I have looked into quite a bit are Medicaid funds that are intended to help the nursing home facilities provide better care for nursing home residents all across the country. And unfortunately, in our country, nursing homes are not doing well, right? Not providing the level of care that's necessary. And often, these residents and poor-performing nursing homes are then used to leverage additional federal Medicaid funds that are routed away from the care for these individuals to general state coffers. So it's a huge concern, and California has engaged in this as well. One of the pieces of information I found regarding a 2013 bill in California is looking at increasing bed taxes regarding both hospitals and I believe also nursing homes, and that effort was targeting to divert $3 billion over I believe a 3-year period into the state general fund, and a lot of it has to do, so this is using federal Medicaid funds intended to provide services for vulnerable populations instead of shifting those into the general revenue. That's not the way the money's intended to be used.
Well, you also found a lot of other information about nursing homes. You write about a scheme developed in Indiana where the state's largest public hospital system has bought up for-profit nursing homes, used them to increase federal Medicaid payments, and then diverted the aid for other purposes rather than improving care to the nursing home's residents. Can you tell us more about how that works?
Sure, and I'm from Indiana, so this was striking to me too to see what my home state was engaging in. And this was happening. This particular example is at a local level. It was and Indianapolis, the Health and Hospital Corporation, which is a municipal agency who runs, you know, the hospital system, the healthcare system within the city, county of Indianapolis. Like you described, the municipal agency discovered that it could buy for-profit nursing homes. And what it was actually doing was buying the licenses to run these for-profit nursing homes, and then sometimes often hiring the very same companies back to then run the nursing homes again. But once it owned the license, it could then claim a higher Medicaid reimbursement rate from the federal government. Indiana has had some of the worst performing nursing homes in the country, has received some of the sometimes the lowest grades in the country regarding quality of care. Yet this hospital system, this municipal agency, was buying up for-profit nursing homes, not just close to Indianapolis, but corner to corner all around the state of Indiana, claiming these federal Medicaid funds that should have been used to provide better care at those facilities for the elderly residents, but instead diverting that money to build a hospital system in downtown Indianapolis. Now, there at least the money is used for a healthcare purpose, right? But that's not the way the money is intended to be used. When you claim Medicaid funds on behalf of a nursing home resident, it's supposed to be used to provide better care for those nursing home residents.
And there are a lot of nursing homes in the United States. Based on a 2014 CDC report, there are 15,600 nursing homes in the United States. 70% are run as for-profit businesses. So we're talking about a lot of money here.
Right. Oh, with these Medicaid diversion practices, we're talking about billions across the country. And this is just one practice. You know, in addition to nursing homes, it's happening in schools and in hospitals that serve a disproportionate share of the poor. One of the examples I mentioned and I describe in the book out of New Jersey is school-based Medicaid claims. So, and this could be the same child. You could have a foster child who's both having his or her disability survivor benefits taken and also being used in a scheme like with school-based Medicaid. So what New Jersey does is it forces school districts to work with a revenue contractor in order to maximize the number of children and the number of claims for children claims to increase federal Medicaid funds intended for poor disabled school children to provide better services for their disabling needs, you know, special education needs. And that's a huge need, right? I mean, that's a good thing if you're getting more aid to provide for those needs and those services. But then right in the state's budget line items, you know, what the state budget is doing, what the Christie administration is doing is, in New Jersey, is diverting over 80% of those federal Medicaid funds intended for poor disabled school children, diverting it into general state coffers, literally taking tens of millions every year from the children.
Is this new under the Christie administration, or did this happen before he became governor?
That's a great question, and it's been continued. So in fairness to the Christie administration, it's continued under multiple governors. Maryland, you know, for example, like the practice with a contract with Maximus to go after children's disability and survivor benefits, that contract was initiated under the O'Malley administration and then continued and expanded under the Hogan administration. So many of these practices are bipartisan. You know, you have, again, governors in red states and blue states that are looking for money wherever they can get it.
And, Daniel, is this widely known in New Jersey? Does this particular issue, for example, get coverage in the local media there?
I don't think it does. I think, again, most people don't know, and that's what I'm hopeful for, is that to increase awareness of it and then increase outrage. Because, you know, the schools, I found other reports in New Jersey that the school systems are so underfunded in New Jersey that they've resorted often to selling ads on the sides of school buses. So these practices have real consequences in terms of the impact on the children or the other vulnerable populations that are intended to benefit from the aid. And it just keeps continuing. You know, like I found examples with foster care agencies and at the state level or at the county level where they're seeking to take resources from children in their care. They're not just stopping with taking disability and survivor benefits through the Social Security Administration. Many states will go further and even take veterans assistance benefits if the children have a parent who died in the military.
Wow.
Right? Including California has done this. Some states will take even more. Maryland the Department of Human Services, that, you know, the whole function of this agency is to serve vulnerable populations, drafted regulations, that it could take not just those benefits, but could take the child's own earnings, could take insurance, could take savings, you name it, you know, from a child in care. I found a Nebraska regulation where the Human Service Agency will even, I mean, there's just a really long list of what the agency will unfortunately take, will even take a burial plot from children in care if they happen to have that in their resources.
Well, you know, we're still scratching our heads over here trying to figure out how this can all happen legally.
Well, I that's a great question. And for each of the issues, I think there can be legal analysis and a legal challenge. With the practice of states taking foster children's benefits, I think there are strong legal challenges that can be brought. Now, that issue has, and a minor piece of the argument went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court found that states, when they acted as representative payees, were not creditors or not violating something called the anti-attachment provision. But the Supreme Court noted there are a whole host of other potential challenges that have not yet been decided, including this idea of a breach of fiduciary obligation. You know, under the federal statutes that govern representative payees, there are also constitutional concerns. In Maryland, I was also involved in litigation where I was helping to represent AMICI, a group of advocacy organizations who filed a brief in support of a foster child represented by the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau. That case went up to the top court in Maryland, the Court of Appeals, and the court did find that the foster care agency was violating children's constitutional due process rights because not giving any notice, as we talked about before. So Maryland, as far as I know so far, is the only state who's reached that result, but I'm hopeful, like, you know, more states will follow suit. Regarding some of the other practices like Medicaid, you know, again, when you look at the statute, the general purpose of these Medicaid funds, the federal Medicaid funds are supposed to provide states with enhanced capacity to provide these Medicaid services. It's supposed to be a match. California is a 50-50 match state, I believe, like Maryland. So if California spends $50 on Medicaid-eligible services, state dollars, then the state can claim $50 from the federal government. That's intended then to match and provide $100 total for Medicaid services. So when that structure is subverted, I think it's in violation of the federal Medicaid statute. Unfortunately, there, the federal government, the Centers for Medicare, Medicaid Services, I think has not clamped down on these practices sufficiently. Regarding some of the other practices, simply because of unawareness, litigation hasn't been brought or legislative efforts to clamp down on it.
Today we are speaking with Daniel Hatcher about his new book, The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. After the break, we'll talk more about what the legal system can do to deal with these issues, and then we'll also talk about some of these private contractors, including one of the biggest, Maximus. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll-free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are launching a special hour of Your Call coming up today at 11 o'clock. We're going to be focusing on local and state issues. There are a lot of issues on the ballot in November. Most of the focus is on the presidential race, but we're going to talk about what's happening in California and across the Bay Area. Today, we'll kick off our series by talking about what's on the San Francisco ballot. 25 measures. 25 just on San Francisco's ballot. So we'll be talking about that today at 11. I hope you can tune in. Tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing media coverage of the United States' role in Saudi Arabia's year-long war on Yemen. And then we'll be talking about that New York Times investigation about how think tanks have become vehicles for corporate influence. That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to weigh in on today's show about Daniel Hatcher's new book and all of the information he exposes, it's called The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. And he writes about how states, in partnership with private contractors, have turned the poor and the most vulnerable into lucrative sources of revenue. So if you are working for a social service agency, if you work for the government and you know about this practice, we would love to have you share your story. You can call in anonymously. And if you have any questions for Daniel, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Before the break, Daniel, we were talking about how the legal system can deal with this. And for any listener who tuned in late, Daniel was telling us a story earlier about how states apply for Social Security benefits for foster children. If their parents pass away, for example, the state becomes the foster child's representative payee to gain access to the fund. In the case of Alex, who was represented by Daniel, the state took every payment Alex should have received. And so we have an email from Delmore in Oakland who said, could there be class actions on behalf of foster children or Medicaid recipients to get these policies changed or get the money back? And are there lawyers that are taking on these kinds of challenges?
That's a great question, and there could be class action lawsuits brought. Unfortunately, sometimes some of the advocates that might be representing foster children are close to these issues, that they come from legal services organizations that receive some federal funds. The Legal Services Corporation does not allow many legal aid lawyers across the country to be involved in class action litigation. But there are possibilities, and actually the case that went up to the Supreme Court that I mentioned before out of Washington State was a class action claim. So that's a great question. One of the challenges is becoming aware. The case that I represented Alex and Maryland, the state argued that Alex's claim was untimely, that because when you file a claim against a state, usually there's something called a Tort Claims Act, and that provides often a shorter statute of limitations period in which you can bring a claim against a government at a state or county level. And the state was saying, well, Alex should have brought his claim within 1 year of when the state started taking his money. He was in foster care. A child didn't even get notice, so he had no idea this was occurring, but the state successfully convinced the court to dismiss his claim because he should have brought it within 1 year of when the state started taking the money. So that's a challenge for advocates out there to be aware of.
You write that obviously this left Alex really struggling. He didn't have any money. He left the foster care system penniless. I'm sure there are so many Alexes across the country. Did you follow him? Do you know where he is today?
I'm still in touch with Alex. We see each other once in a while, both as friends, and I'll give him informal legal advice on different issues he might be struggling with. He's struggled since he's left care, dealing with homelessness and sometimes unemployment. It's a struggle for him. Foster children in our country are not doing well, and we don't know a lot. There aren't many studies out there that track former foster children, foster care alumni sometimes referred to. But what we do know doesn't look good. And these kids, while they're in care, foster children suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder at twice the level of Iraq war veterans. Mm. They need help. They don't need us to take their money away from them.
When you're talking about Social Security, the average benefit is about $800 to $1,000 a month. What is it for foster children?
Well, it depends on the benefit. If it's SSI, the disability benefit, that's a set amount. I think it might be around high $600 to around $700 a month. Now, the survivor benefits, that can range, as you indicated, depending on how much the parent worked and how much was paid into the system, so that level can vary. But from the state perspective, it's actually really not a huge amount of money in terms of, like, the total funding that the states try to use for these foster care-related services. Some estimates I've seen are around maybe 1% of the total state spending or revenue that they're generating to try to provide these services. But for the kids, it's a huge amount of money. You know, if Alex had had that money while he was aging out of care, who knows? You know, maybe it might not have helped put him over the edge towards better success, but at least he would have had a chance.
Mm.
You know, that's at that stage where you just desperately need that assistance and to try to make ends meet as you're making that transition.
In the case of Alex, the state took his money, Maryland. Where did that money go? Are you able to actually follow the money in these cases?
Well, sometimes you can actually see it showing up in state budgets where the money goes. Maryland's a little more obtuse, but through testimony from the various agency leaders before the Maryland General Assembly, it's been clear that what's happening in Maryland is when the state takes this money from foster kids, it results in state savings, right? It's so the state doesn't have to apportion to appropriate more resources to the foster care agencies, and that, therefore, the state doesn't have to raise revenue that way to fund its agency. So they're taking money from kids, so the state doesn't have to fund the foster care agency.
And what about Maryland? Are politicians there working? I mean, do some politicians stand up against this, or are they all in favor of this? Do they even know this is happening?
A great question, and I have been involved in legislation as well in Maryland, so there are members of the Maryland General Assembly that have been trying to stop or at least curtail this practice, and I've worked for a couple of years with Senator Jamie Raskin, a state senator who's now actually running for Congress in Maryland, and bills were introduced 3 years to try to, and initially it was to protect all the children's funds, and this is what I think should happen. These are the kids' monies, right? But as time went forward through the legislation, there was an agreement to actually only try to conserve the funds for those children who are close to aging out of care, and only a part of it, right? Even there, the foster care agency stood up and testified against protecting children's funds, right? And this is the agency, again, sole reason for existing is to protect these kids, is standing up against and testifying in an effort to protect money for those children.
Daniel,
that happened under both administrations, both under the O'Malley administration and under the Hogan administration.
Daniel,
but I'm hopeful. I hope the bill will be reintroduced again in Maryland, and I hope it will move forward.
Daniel Hatcher writes about all of these stories in his new book, The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. He's professor of law at the University of Baltimore. He has worked with foster children at the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau and also the Children's Defense Fund. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Ray in San Francisco. Hi, Ray. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I'm aware of this, like it's going on everywhere. But if the child can get a representative payee before the state gets it, or in some cases even after the state gets it, you can break that. You can break the state's hold on it.
That's a great point, and you are correct to an extent. And there are some places where I've seen contract documents where if somebody else is a representative payee, the state is actually hiring these contractors to come in to try to shift that over to the state agency so they can then take control over the money. But you're right, that even if, and that's something that family members, friends, advocates should be aware of, if this is currently happening and if the state agency is currently the representative payee, it's possible that a family member, a nonprofit organization, you know, someone else could seek to help shift the representative payee to someone else. You could apply to the Social Security Administration to have someone else named as a representative payee. And then the Supreme Court itself has noted that if anyone else is a representative payee, the state can't take that money from the representative payee. So that's an excellent point.
Well, and this is why it's so important to have advocates for foster children, right? Because how is a child supposed to get this information, especially after dealing with the death of a parent or in some cases both parents?
Right, you know, and then this is happening to the full age range, especially if it's just like a 3-year-old child. You know, how is this possible to you know where what's happening? But and then even when it's a teenager, and again, the children and their advocates are not getting any notice across the country, except now, hopefully, in Maryland, if the state is following the Court of Appeals order.
Have you been in touch with foster care agencies, social workers? You know, there's so many people who care so deeply and dedicate their lives to helping foster children. Have you been in touch with them to let them know that this is happening?
Yes, some, and I agree with you. I very much feel that the vast majority of caseworkers want to provide excellent services for their clients. And I think often, unfortunately, they're overworked, underpaid, underappreciated, right? You know, so we need more funds so they can provide the care that's needed. Again, this is happening at the senior level, you know, and often these are individuals who come and go with government. You know, you have the caseworkers who will stay through various administrations, the secretaries of a human service agency appointed by the governor. And sometimes you're going to see an increasing trend in many states where many of these secretaries of human service agencies have a business background and they're sort of focused on profit ideas almost. So it becomes all about the money, unfortunately. And that's where I think this is happening. I have discussed with some agency individuals, and I understand, like, some of them have arguments, well, look, it costs money to provide care for children or other vulnerable populations. So if they have resources, we should be able to take those funds in order to repay the cost of care. But the problem with that, still, my first, you start with a foster care agency shouldn't be in the business of funding itself by taking money from the very children it exists to protect and serve, right? That's nonsensical. Also, I think it's illegal. Again, like, children have no legal obligation to pay for their own care. The foster children don't, nor should they. Mm. And the agency isn't even benefiting from it. You know, again, it's the state reducing budget money to the agency based upon how much money the agency takes from the kids.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ray. Let's go next to Anonymous in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Very important topic. There's a company with the same name, Maximus, that has proposed to build a 100-foot-tall, 300-unit luxury condominium at the corner of 16th and Mission. They're also involved with Park Merced. They filed a lawsuit against the owner. There was a dispute about the property at 16th and Mission. The court filing showed that they were represented by a company, a law firm called Greenberg Traurig of Los Angeles. Is this the same company that is involved with this foster care business?
I'm not familiar with that particular issue example that you're discussing, so I don't know. I have encountered through some of our research that there are more than one organizations out there that use Maximus as a name, so I'm not sure. But I can describe, you know, Maximus I describe as an example in the book regarding the scope of the poverty industry, just in terms of how much that this particular company has been involved in. You know, Maximus in Maryland not only now has this contract to help the state obtain survivor and disability benefits on behalf of foster children. It runs the state, the Baltimore City Child Support Office, and it's all across the country that this company has contracts. I follow a sort of a chain of events as one of the examples in the book. Maximus had a contract with the District of Columbia, with Washington, D.C., to help claim Medicaid funds on behalf of foster children for the District of Columbia. There were investigations, there were allegations, including False Claims Act by the federal government. Department of Justice was involved, and there was a settlement agreement, a deferred prosecution, regarding alleged Medicaid fraud, right, for filing claims for Medicaid that were knowingly untrue. And this was over $30 million that the company agreed to pay as part of the settlement agreement. Within just a short time of that, of these allegations of the settlement of alleged Medicaid fraud, the company received a statewide contract with New York to help New York run its Medicaid fraud program. And then within just a short time of that, extended the very contract in the District of Columbia. It obtained either new or extended contracts contracts with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services of over $200 million worth, which is the federal agency to which the alleged fraudulent Medicaid claims were submitted. And then, within a short time of that, Maximus obtained a contract with the Department of Justice itself.
The Maximus does business also in the UK, Canada, Australia, Saudi Arabia. So this is a major private sector corporation.
It is. And you're seeing this growth both in companies like Maximus, whose core niche really is in poverty-related program services. And as you indicated, Maximus is not just in the United States. It's also striking to see how many companies are involved that this might not be their core business. One of the things I talk about in the book is a comparison of these practices of the poverty industry to the military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And some of those very same companies that are involved, have historically involved in the military-industrial complex, have found the amount of money to be made in the poverty industry. Companies like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, right, are also involved in child support-related services, just to name one.
Can you tell us how exactly?
Sure. Well, you know, Lockheed Martin at one point had the contract in Baltimore City to help run the entire Baltimore child support office, and I believe the company has also had a contract with the federal government to help with. There's a process with that, the federal level, in terms of what's called a new hire directory and efforts to locate parents, right, in this process of seeking to obtain information in order to pursue child support. So you have the privatization there as well. And then you have companies like Arthur Anderson, which is now consulting, now Accenture, Deloitte, IBM. I mean, the list continues on how many companies have parts of its company now that is focused on the federal aid intended for vulnerable populations as a source of contracts. So there's a lot of money there, and companies are noticing.
You also report that Lockheed Martin got a $124 million contract when the Social Security Administration needed help in making digital copies.
Right. You know, so that's just an example from, you know, really, you know, somewhat small. That's not really a small amount of money, but very large. I mean, the poverty industry companies, we've reached a point where they're doing everything. There's an example I discuss in the book, even where you have contractors hired to manage the contract process, you know, because you have a state or a state agency decides it doesn't have the ability to monitor the decisions of how it's going to put out an RFP and decide which contractors to decide upon, hires a different contractor to help with that. It's crazy.
We were interested in Maximus's relationship with California, and Maximus got a 5-year extension that began on January 1st, 2011, was estimated to cost the state $360 million. I said earlier that Maximus is partnering with California's CHIP program. That's California's health insurance program, the largest in the country, serving over 885,000 children. And under this contract extension, Maximus is providing administrative services to help uninsured children access health, dental, and vision coverage.
Right, and so again, we're talking about a lot of money. And look, you know, in the book, you know, privatization is a concern to me, but that's not the focus of my book in terms of whether or not a state should be engaging in contracts with a private company. Right, there are examples. You know, I'm not familiar with the details of that contract, but it could be, you know, that the company is providing a helpful service to the state in order to help get more children enrolled in the CHIP, the Medicaid program for them, and then to administer the process.
Well, to that point, how transparent is a company like Maximus? Are
That's
they held
a great question,
accountable?
And sometimes I found that with state FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests, you know, sometimes getting state documents can be tricky if then it involves a private company and whether the private company will fight against that. And there are examples all around the country where there have been privatization, including in the foster care system and with Medicaid-related issues, where there's been some really significant concerns, and it's usually not more efficient. The argument for, like, bringing in privatization into the Medicare program many years ago, what was created was called Medicare Part C, which is now termed Medicare Advantage, which allowed private HMOs, private companies, to come in to help participate as a choice for individuals who are, you know, senior citizens who become eligible for Medicare. That's been more expensive from the beginning, although it was sold to the public as it was supposed to be a cost saver, but it wasn't.
Well,
it's always been more expensive.
And I could hear people reading your book saying, see, government is completely corrupt. This is why we need to get rid of these programs and privatize them.
Well, I disagree. Again, you know, like I think there are concerns that need to be exposed and need to be fixed. But if you have a problem where you have a cash-strapped state that is misusing federal aid intended for the vulnerable, we need to find a way to stop that misuse, right? Because the vulnerable populations still need that assistance. It also raises a great point. You know, you're seeing many proposals from, say, Paul Ryan has proposed this, even in, you know, Donald Trump, and then his website wants to block grant the Medicaid program, and this has been proposed with other federal aid programs as well. The argument is essentially, let's just give all the money to the states and let states do whatever they want, right? I mean, the huge problem with that is if you have a cash-strapped state, if you have a governor who, under a complex regulatory framework, is using budget shell games to maximize and then divert Medicaid funds from intended purpose, what's that governor going to do if he or she is given a blank check saying, please use the money to help the poor, right? It's going to result in much more misuse of the public aid.
Daniel, we're almost out of time. In your book, you say that awareness and outrage will change this. Are you getting many invites in the national media to talk about these issues?
Thank you for that question. And I am getting some interest both from the press and from congressional interest. So I'm hopeful that awareness will spur needed change. I also received an invite from the Social Security Advisory Board to come talk to them about these practices. So now the federal agency that manages the program we've been discussing regarding foster children and foster children's benefits is looking at this, and that agency could fix this right now.
Well, we will definitely follow this. We'd love to have you back. Daniel Hatcher is author of The Poverty Industry, The Exploitation of America's Most Vulnerable Citizens. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the United States' role in Saudi Arabia's year-long war on Yemen. We'll also talk about an investigation about how think tanks have become vehicles for corporate influence. The report exposes how the Brookings Institution promoted Lennar Corporation's $8 billion San Francisco shipyard project while receiving $400,000 from the company. Join us live at 10 o'clock on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, we revisit my conversation with the oldest active park ranger in the United States, Betty Reed Soskin. She's been celebrated for ensuring that the African American wartime experience has a prominent place in the park's history. She talks about her work and shares some life lessons on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
Tavis Smiley Show. Tomorrow at noon here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio. You can find us online at kalw.org. Up next at 11 o'clock, it's a special presentation of Your Call. On Thursdays, we'll be doing an election series with the Your Call folks, and that's coming up next right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. Stay tuned.
This is a special second hour of Your Call. Every Thursday through Election Day, we'll be covering local and state issues and the democratic process. We're kicking off this special today by focusing on the San Francisco ballot, which includes a whopping 25 measures. There will be 25 measures on San Francisco's ballot. We'll also talk about important supervisor races, and we'll follow the money. Last year, spending on local elections in San Francisco was the highest on record, reaching nearly $28 million. So what can we expect this election? Join us after the news.